Tonight's going to be a little bit different in the sense that I'm going to want you to do some homework with me, and it's going to be even more that the second hour when we talk about methodologies of biblical and systematic theology. So it's going to be important for you to work with me in this. The part that we're on tonight is the nature of the church, part one, and I'm going to have you do some spade work with me so that you can not only grasp my point, but see my point, and we'll be building some things up piece by piece. Some of the pieces will seem real basic, and you'll wonder why you're doing this. So if the thought comes up to you, why are we doing this? I have expected this. But it's like a lot of things that are in Scripture. If you don't grasp it, and then ponder it a little bit, you don't understand what you have in your hands. And it has value to it. I hope you'll see that and not have any question to it. The first thing that we want to touch on is the word that's used for church in the New Testament. And it's ekklesia. It's in Greek. I'm going to use some Greek tonight. But it's also available in English to you. I'll just transliterate it, because I may spell it wrong. We get the word in English, ecclesiastical, from it, so it shouldn't look all that bad in Greek, ekklesia. It's made of two pieces. Sometimes etymology is helpful, not entomology, but etymology. Sometimes you can look at the pieces of a word and they really do give you a flavor for what the word means. Sometimes they don't. For example, the word barn dance, if you think it's a barn dancing, you are led down the wrong road, or a housefly, you know, you got to kind of get things right. But a lot of times it gives you an idea of what you're working with. Ek is the preposition out or out of. Klesia comes from kaleo. Again, if you like to doodle, that's fine, but it means to call. And so the first piece of the meaning of ekklesia is to be called out of. But it carries a secondary meaning that really has eclipsed part of the first meaning, which is not only to be called out of, but to be called together. In Greek, the term for the Greek assembly, one of the Greek assemblies, was the ekklesia. So it wasn't just a matter that they were called out of the local areas from which they were and called together to help govern in that case. But it was the gathering itself. And so rather than focusing on the being called out of, it has as much focus as being called together or looking at it as a group. You do recognize that the verb call is pretty important in the New Testament. To this end, you were called. Jesus called. Paul called people in the gospel. And so the church is composed of those who have been called by God and responded to that call in faith. So that's where we get the word church. Any comments or questions on that?
So most of the time that call is in the New Testament, would that be ecclesia?
If you see the verb, it's going to be this verb most of the time. I can't say all the time because I didn't check it today. And sometimes I forget. But it's a fairly frequent term. Even the other noun, klesis, make your calling sure, is a derivative of this verb. Okay, the term ekklesia occurs a lot, and we'll be using a lot. As a matter of fact, a lot of the work that I did is out of the Greek concordance, so there it's a one-to-one correspondence. Okay, I'll leave the other on. Now, we've got the etymology of it, what the pieces are that make up the word, and we've got a little bit of sense of how it was used in the culture of the day. It was used of a group that was called together for a function, and we know that it's relative to the church. Now we take out the spade, and you just start going through things. This would look like tedium to some people, just to open a concordance and look and watch the way the word is used over and over again. Today it's getting more fun, especially if you pick up a biblical program on your computer, because you can kind of throw these in a big pile, and then if you've got an outlining program, you can kind of move them around and put them in categories in easier ways than you could time ago. and some of the abilities to pick up words. You can get the King James Bible as shareware or freeware someplace, and if you have a word processing program, all you have to do is put search, find, and you can get them that way. And you can get other Bible programs that are pretty cheap. So what I'm talking about is not super high tech in the sense that you have to invest $500 in it. You don't need that much. On the other hand, you can do this with a concordance and just do it by hand. If you do it this way, you will remember it. Okay, it's one of the blessings of it. If you actually take the figurative shovel out and start moving the earth and doing it, it sits in a way deeper in your thinking than me just telling you things tonight. So you'll want to remember that. Okay, so let's start turning the spade. One of the things that I'm going to tell you is we find the word church used in the plural. That sounds, again, it sounds super rudimentary, but we got to prove it first. We'll find it used inferred in the plural and in the actual plural. For example, Acts 14:23. Some of you who are quick flippers, turn to it. You want to make sure that I'm not leading you astray here. In Acts 14:23, the plural form is not going to be used, but the inferred plural is absolutely clear, I think. Anyone got 14:23? Okay. Okay, go ahead and read it.
Okay, Paul and Barnabas church.
In what church?
Each church.
Okay, so that it's used each. You got to have more than one to do that. 1 Corinthians 4:17. 1 Corinthians 4:17. Okay. Let's have it.
Okay. 4:17. For this reason I am sending you Timothy, my son, who I may love, who is faithful in the Lord. He will remind you of my way in life in Christ Jesus, which agrees with what I teach everywhere.
In which church?
Every church.
So, in order, again, for that to make sense, church has to be used in a plural form. Okay. Now, to back that up over and over again, I'll just give you a string of references. Acts 15:41, he went through Syria and Cilicia, strengthening the churches, plural. Acts 16:5, so the churches, plural, were strengthened in faith and grew daily in numbers. Romans 16:4, they risked their lives for me, not only I, but all the churches of the Gentiles are grateful to them. And then a string of whole witnesses. You know, there's just lots of them. So what we can say absolutely assuredly is the word church is used in a plural sense, not just in an overall sense. Okay, at a local level, we find the church identified by its location. This is another point. So the point one is it's used in the plural. Point two is when it's used in a local sense, it's identified by its location. Okay, Acts 8:1. Acts 8:1. You want to read it? Okay, how's the church identified? It's the church at Jerusalem. Now, it helps if you already have a feel for the book of Acts within this. By Acts chapter 8, about how many believers do we have in Jerusalem? Do you have a feel for it? The first sermon that Peter preaches ends up with 2,000, 3,000 believers, and by 4 or 5 you have either up to 5,000 or another 5,000. So suffice it to say, the church size by Acts chapter 8 is already in the many thousands. Given the sense of structures available in Jerusalem at the time, you could say, well, one, they met in the temple area. The temple area is pretty big. But that isn't the ecclesia in its pure form. It's the ecclesia plus non-believing Judaism, right? If some of you came to know Christ in a group that had the scriptures but didn't have rebirth with it. You could relate to attending there and the birth of the Free Church in Scandinavia would have been like that, because in its inception, the church was a state entity. The pastors were licensed by the government, and the government never required rebirth as a qualification for ministers back then. As a result of it, many churches were dead. The whole idea of spiritual life in it was just not emphasized at all. And so when people started to come into Christ through the reading of Scripture, some of the people that read the Scripture were converted by reading it. You know, look at this. Others were converted by people visiting Scandinavia and just preaching the gospel in a clear form. But they would go where they'd gone all of their life, and they would be outnumbered by people who didn't believe. Okay. Now, they would hear the word in a different way from other people within that. So the temple area would have been something like that. They would go there, the apostles would teach there, but so would a lot of the Pharisees, Sadducees, those who were in teachers of the law position, and you'd hear good and bad. When the church met as the church, in fact, in Jerusalem, they would likely be in homes and synagogues, and you'll see that as we cover some of the other things. But when the church is described, it's described not as the many gatherings in this sense, but they're described as the church, singular, at Jerusalem. Do you see it? It's the church at Jerusalem. That's right. It's not referring to a building at all. That's an important concept. In America, if you say the word church, most often in people's minds, building. Building. If they're used to Christmas cards, it's a building with a steeple on with snow falling and that goes with it. The people aren't identified as the church so much as the building in a lot of places. There are a couple other places where that's mentioned. Acts 11:22, Acts 15:4. Another site where that's done is Acts 13:1 of Antioch. Acts 13:1. In the church at Antioch, there were prophets and teachers. And I could write the Greek out for you. That wouldn't help you. It looked nice for me. But I want you to know they identified it that way. And again, what was, in terms of size-wise, what feel do you have for the church at Antioch? Those of you who've read Acts in the last year or so. Do you remember? Was it just a small house church? Or do you have a? It was large. Well, can you tell me anything about it?
All I know is that
Right. Who got Paul to come there? Barnabas got him to come there. Why was Barnabas up there in the first place? Barnabas was up there because the movement, the conversion rate to Christ in Antioch was so heavy that it concerned Jerusalem. They wanted to know whether this was real conversion or was this some kind of a syncretistic. Does everybody know when I use syncretistic? It means a mix, a slurry of something. Is it just a mixture of kind of pseudo-Christianity with Judaism and Gentilism, because this is happening now among the Gentiles in Antioch? Is it really of God? Barnabas is commissioned to leave Jerusalem to go up there and see that. When he gets up there and sees it, it really is a work of God, but it's so big. It is so big that he can't handle it. And so he goes and gets Paul because of the size of it. And I don't remember whether it's 13 or just a little bit later on, but it lists all the teachers and prophets in Antioch. There's quite a pile of them there. Antioch becomes the new Jerusalem, as it were. It becomes the place where Paul's missionary journeys are sent out from. Okay? So when you say the church at Antioch, again, you're working into the many hundreds to thousands of people who have come to Christ up there. But even though there would have been that many, and they would have been meeting probably in homes, possibly in a rented facility too, if we could extrapolate to Paul backwards. Nevertheless, when the church was addressed in Acts 13:1, it's the church singular at Antioch. Not the churches in Antioch, but the church singular. Okay? That's just true, right? You read the text and that's what it is. Yes.
So you're saying that the Greek word is called ekklesia in the plural sense?
You're just looking at the spelling form. This form here is in the singular. Oh yeah, Greek has both. These cases that we picked off all are plural in English and plural in Greek. There's a one-to-one correspondence on it. Okay. The situation that we're looking on now is in areas where we know there were hundreds, or in case of Jerusalem, very clearly, thousands of believers that wouldn't have fit in any local synagogue that we're aware of. You couldn't stuff them in there. If any of you have attended a church where the auditorium held 100 people or 150 people, that's what you're looking at. You don't get 4,000 people in a building like that, no matter how aggressive you are. It doesn't work. So you're given to see, really, that there are numbers of meeting places in the city, and yet that whole totality is addressed as the church at Jerusalem. And in Antioch, in this case, it's the church, singular, at Antioch. Likewise, in Kenchre, I don't know if that sounds familiar to you, that's near Corinth. Romans 16:1, I commend to you our sister Phoebe, a servant of the church, singular, at Kenchre. You can see that also with Caesarea. Let me force you to do the spade work just so you know that I'm being okay with this. Acts 18:22. Who's got it? Okay, so it isn't the churches here, it's church singular. So this is the church at Caesarea, Acts 20, verse 17. Okay, so it's the elders of the church, singular, at Ephesus. What do we know about the size of the church at Ephesus? Just to put real practical stuff together. Do you remember how it was for Paul in Ephesus? Remember the struggles that he had there? It was a really tough time. There was a lot of what we call Satan worship, cult worship. Matter of fact, there was a time in the ministry where they brought in all of this black magic stuff. This was in Ephesus and burned it. Do you ever remember reading the figures on this? Do you know what it would be equivalent to in American income? It's big bucks. It's tens to hundreds of thousands of dollars worth if you convert it up. If you take, I think the NIV Study Bible has it in man's day wages, and that's the way it's given. So if you convert it into that and say, this is what a hired individual or a person who worked could glean in their day, and say it would take that many days to buy the stuff they have, you bring it over into American on that kind of a basis and you have tens to hundreds of thousands of dollars worth. You say, okay, then how many people are we talking about? Yeah, and it ends up being a lot of people again, doesn't it? But nevertheless, despite the size of the work there, and Ephesus was in a pretty big metropolitan area, when he calls for the elders, he doesn't call for the elders of the churches, plural. He calls for the elders of the church. Okay, and we want to catch the significance of that in a moment. Everyone understand what I'm saying here? Singular, singular, singular. You can see the same thing with Philippi and Thessalonica. Thessalonians, 1 Thessalonians 1:1. 1 Thessalonians 1:1. Paul, Silas, and Timothy to the church of the Thessalonians, church singular of the Thessalonians. You say, okay, all right, I agree with you. We find the word used in the plural. We find the word church being identified with a church in the singular at a location, i.e., the city where it was located. So what? What implication does that have? I've done all of that spade work. What difference does it mean? Have any of you thought what difference that means?
They are not very...
So they tend to see themselves as separate. They don't picture themselves as part of the church in Bremerton or the church in Silverdale or the church in Seebeck or Paulsbo or whatever. Okay? That's significant, isn't it? Because if it's that way, then the thinking of believers has changed from what it was in the beginning. Okay? That's one of the very important parts. The way we perceive ourselves is different than the way they perceive themselves in the New Testament time period. There's on the flip side of this, there's a negative run to it. There are at least two groups that I know that emphasize this point and miss the point all at the same time. There's a group that just would jump up and down with a point that there was only one church in one city. They do that wherever they are. Any of you know the name of the group? The local church. Any of you heard of the local church? The local church. That's the name of it. Because they go by the local name. Okay? Church of Seattle. There's one in Pullman. It's called the Church of Pullman. Okay? Now, you say, well, why is that negative? Here's why it's negative. They move into the area. They say, listen, if you read your Bible, it will always say the church at Corinth, the church at Rome, the church at Jerusalem. And so we're biblical, and you aren't. You attach a name on the end of your church, which isn't like it is in Scripture. We're right, you're wrong. We're the church. Is that right? But they're missing the point. And that's true. And to show you how practical it is, I had an interchange with one of the elders in that church, with one or two of the men from his church. This is several years ago now. And we were in the basement of One Way Books at the time. And he had been harping on this particular point, so I got together and said, well, how do you identify the church? How do you identify with the church? What is the church composed of? And I know you have problems with the way the church is called, but you've assumed that since something else is attached to the name, that that's unbiblical. Your job is to show what's unbiblical about the way that we approach things. And he became very irate and hostile. It's so much so that the fellows from his church came back and apologized to me. I said, we were just embarrassed at the way he acted. We're sorry. But he had just assumed we got the right name. We're the group. Nobody else is. Okay? If you haven't run into that, one or two of you have, you probably will in the course of time. But again, if you know the Scriptures well, that doesn't throw you. You don't go, oh, you know, my word, he's right. On the other hand, we may be missing a large part of the point. And the point is, from God's perspective, when you get an area, he doesn't see it the way we see it so much. And if he were to write a letter to the church at Bremerton, would the saints all get the letter? Or would they be so chopped up? Okay, now, if we're going to push that and make it a little more practical, how is the unity that's inherent in the way the word church is used reflected, or how can it be reflected in a real sense of unity and not just kind of glossing over things and say, well, you know, we're all one, really. We don't talk to each other, but I mean, in what ways can the church function to reflect a reality that's true in the eyes of God? Any very practical thoughts that you have? Yes. Okay, and the fact that we're meeting together. So this is a meeting format in which the other things are not emphasized and we come together as one. What are other ones that really are an evidence of that kind of a unity? They actually get together. They actually pray for one another. Okay? That's important, I think. You know, there are pastors that won't participate in that.
Yeah.
Okay.
You want the inner church.
So there's an attitude that's not provincial or possessive that some of the churches have exhibited towards another. That's a good, that's very practical.
Also, another unity is that among the pastors, in fact, I don't even know who she is.
Okay, so to respect maybe some discipline matters that weren't taken care of at a previous fellowship and say that's important to us that you approach that. There's some other ways this prayer meeting that's sometimes reflected in a gathering called a prayer summit that's particularly active within the Northwest is one way that unity really is shown. Another that's up and coming for the last, I don't know, 4 or 5 years among the men is Promise Keepers. Okay? And there everybody gets to forget that they're Baptist or Presbyterian or Foursquare or whatever and that. Now, the thing that you have to be careful when you do that is you're not running lowest common denominator and you're gutting the scriptures of their authority and power. You don't want to do that. And we'll get into some of that. So if that matters to you in a practical way, let's suppose you're lost your pastor for whatever reason and you're looking for a new minister, which is true in at least one of the cases that I'm aware of. And if this is important to you, one of the things that you would want to ask a pastoral candidate is, how do you view the church? How do you look at the church? Is the church the denomination that you came from? How's the church identified? How is it made up? Reinforce this idea that God has, that there really is a church in a given area, and they're meant. What do you do about that practically? And there are other things that you can think of, doing an Easter service together or holding some joint services where the community actually gets to perceive some of the unity becomes very important. But it's drawn out of the fact that as God looks at it, he's not impressed by all of our denominations. And some of the subtleties that are really important to us are really depressing to him. Okay? And you just get this from that, don't you? Do you see how that it drops out? This is the way it's used. This is the way it's used. Okay. Move on. Another facet that we see as we study the church is that when it meets, it isn't just in an ecclesia-type building. Oftentimes, it's in a home. Romans 16:5. Okay. So, the church that meets at their house or in their house. You can say, wow, that church must have been fairly small. Yes. They may have met occasionally outside, but the likelihood is that they met in homes, many homes. There'll be a transition point in which the churches are trying to gather more, and you'll see a move towards their own structure. In some cases, perhaps when a whole Jewish synagogue were converted, the natural place to meet would be that location. All of these things would be happening. So it wouldn't be a real simple picture. One of it that we can see clearly in Romans 16:5 is one of the gatherings, and although it's in Romans, it's not referring, it's not written from Rome, it's written from Corinth. But it's written from Corinth to somebody in Rome who has a church at their house. It would hopefully help us not to despise small things. Right? I mean, after a body gets going and you have 200-300 believers and down the block there's a 5 or 6 cars parked in front of a house and they call themselves a church and you think, they call themselves a church. Ugh. You say, hey, right here, that individual ought to be invited to the pastoral prayer group. Yeah, you know, assuming he's a godly man. If he's not, they ought to pray about it the other way. Also, 1 Corinthians 16:19. 1 Corinthians 16:19. Okay, who has it? Okay. Now, are you familiar with this couple, Aquila and Priscilla? They're one of the pioneer church planters of their time. They were the couple that moved from Corinth with Paul when he was on his way back to Jerusalem. They moved back across to Ephesus and started the ministry within a synagogue in Ephesus before there was a church there. And after they were there for a while, the church was in their home. Okay? So, we've already gotten some implications here. This will highlight something that somebody already drew the conclusion already. Church is not equal to a building. The church meets sometimes in buildings. Okay, so we have to be careful with ourselves, lest we pick up the old American habit of identifying a church with a building. That's not the church. That is not the church. Now, all the things that we've hit here are profound. If you've fallen into the idea that the church is the building, over the course of time, the real church dies. When we were on our way out here from Chicago area, where I went to seminary, we stopped in Lakota, North Dakota, which was where Mary Lou's dad was born. And we stayed there, and while we were there, it turns out that the minister of the church where he had attended a long time ago was out of town, and they found out I was in town and had graduated from seminary, and they came over and said, "Would you preach?" Okay, I'll do that. So I went over and preached the gospel, and man, what a dead group. He said, "Well, why do the people come?" They come because they always came to church. They didn't come as the church. They came to the church. Now, there was one exception. There was a lady in her 80s there, a lady by the name of Mabel Hauser. And when I read from Romans about the justification that came by faith, and was just reading sections like that to her, she just lit up. I mean, you looked across the rest of it, just like stone, like flint. Say, look, we're talking about how you pass from death to life. Doesn't move you, huh? No. Okay. So where's the church? There's the walls, there's the seats. But where's the church? Church had been reduced, as best I could tell that Sunday, to one woman. Okay. Because she knew the difference. And the rest of them had thought the church was a building. Okay, now I'm going to hit situations where the church is described, and you know you're not working with one local church, not the church at Jerusalem, not the church at Antioch, but broader than that, and the word is used singularly to describe the whole. Okay, Matthew 16:18. Matthew 16:18. Singular or plural? Singular, right? I will build my church. Not I will build my church as. I will build my church. Acts 8:3. But Saul began to destroy the church. Singular. Now, if you know anything about Saul, did he confine his work to Jerusalem? No. Now, as a matter of fact, when he was converted, he was on his way to Damascus. Damascus is not immediately next to Jerusalem. He was covering, all the churches of Judea knew about him. He'd covered the area well. And yet, when it's described, what they say is that Paul began to destroy the church, singular. Acts 9:31. Okay, so how do you know there's more than one local group that are all summed up as singular? These aren't even city names, are they? Is Judea a city? Is Galilee a city? Is Samaria a city? What are those? Those are regions. In our area, it would be called the Palouse, I think. It would be that kind of an area. Or a county might be appropriate too. Would this be Kitsap? Okay, this would be Central Kitsap, okay? So the church in the Central Kitsap. So we find there's a concept of church that encompasses the whole. So when you're thinking of the church, you dare not think too provincially. You have to realize that, and if you think of this, that it involves some challenging things right away. For example, if I told a Jew about the church in Samaria, oh, Samaria, what do you mean, church in Samaria? Isn't that an oxymoron? Say, hey, it's the church in Samaria and Judea, and that's all one. Do you see how that changes the way you think about it? Because, I mean, all of us are infected with our own customs, and they're, of course they're right, and the way that we sing, and the way that we culturally relate to, of course that's right, or is it? And the church, as is described, is broader swath than that. Okay, when Acts 12, it was about this time, it says, then King Herod arrested some who belonged to the church, and he doesn't specify it other than that. And Herod's dominion was more than one city. 1 Corinthians 15:9, another example. For I am the least of the apostles and do not even deserve to be called an apostle because I persecuted the church. The church. Same thing, Philippians 3:6. As for zeal, persecuting the church. So the church is described many times with a word that just encompasses all local gatherings of believers, whether they happen to be in a region that speaks your language or another language, your customs or another custom. Some of this would be like describing to some of the believers in Japan, churches in Korea, and some of the churches in Korea, churches in Japan. Do you understand? There's a big rift. I mean, they may look the same to you and me, but they know the difference. They know the difference. Okay, to fit in with that, I've got a chapter here, but I don't have the verse. 1 Corinthians, I think it's chapter 1. The verse that I'm looking for goes this way. Is Christ divided? Is Christ divided? 1:13? Okay. What kind of a manner is it said there? Can you tell? Is it a theoretical question, or is Paul kind of steamed at the moment? Oh, yeah, it's when Paul thinks of the church being pieced up and divided up, he's not thinking, well, that's fine. I mean, he's going up in smoke, isn't he? Isn't that what the text says? Okay, now, we're going to get practical about this. I'm going to take a point here and we'll get into it even more in the next hour. Start naming different churches. Denominations.
Baptist.
Okay, so we'll just go. Isn't it Heinz here? Okay. When we get to Catholic, it gets to be a little bit different. And part of it is if you deal with the core. About a night ago, I talked about core beliefs. And when you get to Catholicism, it starts to catch the core. And even that gets hard because if you go to church councils, it cuts the core. If you talk to some of your neighbors don't know the Catholic core and they're Catholic. So I'm going to let that one go for the moment.
Alliance.
Which?
Alliance.
Alliance. Okay.
Yeah.
CNMA.
Yeah.
Orthodox. Here, I'd have to know which one you meant. Otherwise, we'd be in a cult. Assembly of God. Okay. Sorry? It's a denomination.
Oh, okay.
I think we got that one. Excuse me?
Oh.
Congregational? Oh, yeah. International? Okay. Church of God? Church of Christ. Now, we haven't covered hardly any of the field. We haven't singled out any specific black denominations. No, they're not. No, there are some with names that are six names long. The most apostolic. Yeah, I mean that's one of five names that runs in. So there are just lots of these, and usually the names are there because of something that's distinctive, that's emphasized. So let's pick out what's emphasized. How about Presbyterian? Okay, so it's ecclesiology, right? We'll just put church government because that's easier, right? I think this also tends to be Reformed. Tens. Okay. Episcopalian, again, is the church government. And there's also, if you'll pardon me, a formalism. What differs Methodists? Okay, so again, here we're making some generalizations, and we want to know that we're doing that. But okay, they're Wesleyan. We'll have to comment on what Wesleyan is. Well, that is.
Well, but Wesley didn't start out that way.
No,
that was how it's.
No, but there was a distinctive doctrine that set Wesley apart. If you go back to England and look at a major work that God did in England in the late 1700s into the early 1800s, you have, amazingly enough, you have a real strong Calvinist, and you have Wesley. Okay, who's the strong Calvinist? Probably the greatest preaching, Whitfield. Able to speak to more before the microphone was invented than probably anybody else that we are aware of. He spoke to crowds up around 30,000, no microphone. He was awesome speaker, just awesome speaker. And Wesley wasn't. He was a tremendous organizer, though. Tremendous organizer. But if you look, both men deeply used by God, same time period, and yet their doctrines really moved each other apart. I mean, they were at it with one another. They started out together. They were actually in the same group called the Holy Club at Oxford, Cambridge, one of those, and moved apart after Whitfield had come to America and interacted with Jonathan Edwards. And then came back, and when he came back, I mean, Wesley and he were really at different ends of the spectrum. They were against each other in their doctrine, and then came back together towards the end. I don't know if you know that. If my memory is right, Whitfield requested Wesley to do his funeral. And you can see that. You say, well, the doctrine that really alienated John Wesley was the way that Whitfield, Calvinism came out, was really strong. The doctrine that bothered Whitfield concerning Wesley was not his Arminianism so much, but his doctrine of perfection. Okay? Ha! You didn't know that. That's still an issue today in one of the churches that we have named up here. mean that you reach a secondary stage in your life where you don't sin. That's the Nazarene doctrine. That's what separates their doctrine from others. Okay? Baptists. Baptism. Now you're going to watch things that become issues. Became an issue here in what city in Europe? Germany. This is in Switzerland. Where Calvin was. Geneva. Ah, there we go. Because Menno Simons was drowned for his believer's baptism position by Calvinists in Geneva. Did you know that? Yeah. I am told by somebody who was at Geneva, they still have a couple of these things on display. They had kind of long levers with baskets where they put the individuals who held to believer's baptism over the river, and I forget the name of the river, and they would put them underwater and say, "Do you still believe this? Do you still believe this?" And eventually they just drowned quite a number of Mennonites. Menno Simons is the founder of the Mennonites. So you look at all of this and you're thinking, God, is this your mindset? Is this what you had in mind? Or what's going on here? Okay? Yeah, and you think, why doesn't this trouble us more? There's a problem within liberalism that just throws out all doctrine and says, oh, let's just all join together. But there's a problem beyond that within God's people where we don't know the difference between primaries and secondaries. And we don't know how to work with other brethren, sistren, on how to, once we're in that position, we don't know how to work it in such a way where the unity is recognized, even though real convictions are not slid over or made unimportant. We just don't face it. And the world knows that. The world knows that real well, which is one of the really difficult problems we have. Because the greatest apologetic ever given for convincing non-Christians that God sent His Son is what? The unity of the church, isn't it? By this will all men know that you're My disciples if you have love for one another. Now you can find all the other apologetics and the ontological argument and the argument for design, and you can catch all this, but I'll tell you the one that has the greatest impact on the unbelievers is the love between Christians. When revival takes place, does it ever stay within a single denomination? Can any of you say, I read about revivals and they only stayed in this one little group? Just rode right across them, didn't it? Yeah, a lot of times, because they wouldn't fit in a building. Very quickly, buildings were exhausted in terms of what they were capable of. And when you look at the results, many evangelical churches' numbers all went up together. And we're afraid that some other is going to get the fruit of evangelistic meetings, so we won't work with them. Okay, so I want you to see, if you just take the word and you start studying, you say, well, listen, church means those called out. And you can see that in the gospel. People are called out of darkness by the message of the gospel. They're called into life. They're called out of darkness into light. That happens. But they're also called together. They're called to be a part of a whole that's the product of Christ and not your own human ingenuity. And yet there are gatherings that reflect in a real way the church. And so there are local churches, and that's legitimately so. You should be able to move from one region to another and join with another group of believers. And going to church is not going to a building. It's not going to a building. It's meeting with other people who have been called out in Jesus Christ, have become one in Him. There's some sense in which we've sometimes lost the ability to recognize fellow believers, but you and I know in the workplace and in the neighborhood how important it is to be able to distinguish the church from that which is not the church. If you're out on a ship in the sea, your goal is not to find, say, hey, there's nobody E-free here, I guess I don't have any fellowship. You didn't have that luxury. And being able to identify one another, it's kind of like AIDS. AIDS is a bad disease because your immune system doesn't know how to recognize body from non-body. When the church gets that way, it destroys itself.